Karen Conti here, subbing in for Brian Noonan on this beautiful July 5th, winding down a beautiful weekend. We have a little serious topic right now, and one that has been timely for a while now. Dennis Hastert, our former Speaker of the House, Jerry Sandusky, Josh Duggar, Bill Cosby, all accused of sexual misconduct with minors. We've seen a lot of these high-profile cases of sexual abuse, and for everyone we see, we know there's probably thousands that are unreported and unpublished. And I want to focus on these cases with two of the best lawyers in the country for dealing with the sex abuse cases, Joe Klest and Eugene Hollander. Welcome to the show. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thanks, Karen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
In 2011, Joe Klest announced a $28 million verdict in favor of a sex abuse victim. It was the largest in Illinois history and one of the largest in the nation. Eugene Hollander has settled numerous sexual abuse cases into the millions of dollars and recently won against priest Daniel McCormick, who is guilty of abusing many, many young men and boys in the Chicago area. Thank you for coming here and discussing this. I want to talk a little bit about the victims. I want to talk about the predators, and I want to talk about how the legal system deals with these issues criminally and civilly. And I know we've had some changes in the law relating to these things. Let's talk a little bit about the traits of the people who are perpetrators of the crime. I want to start with you, Joe. Joe, you used to work for a lawyer who represented serial killer John Gacy. Is that right?
That's true.
So that was your first kind of touch with that kind of case.
Yeah, I mean, it was, and he was a child molester. He was an anti-homosexual.
Right. And he killed 33 young boys and men and buried most of them under his property. So you now, years later, are representing victims of sex abuse. What are the predators like?
Boy, you know, it's really hard to categorize them. They come in all shapes and forms. I think a lot of them were abused themselves, so they somewhat naturalized it in a sense, where they felt it was normal.
Right.
But I really can't give you a general category. They're all shapes and sizes.
And that's probably why it's such a scary thing, because we don't know what they look like. Gene, do you have any the traits that you see in some of the people that you've deposed over the years who have, you're mostly a Catholic priest?
Sure. You know, my experience has been that oftentimes in terms of grooming behavior, they kind of gain the trust of the victims, take them to sporting events, become very friendly, strike a relationship up with them, and then they see if they're receptive to abuse.
And, you know, the idea, of course, is not the sexual conduct. It's the power over the victim. And what I see a lot is that we have people, you know, who may be in politics or may have a lot of money or a sense of celebrity. And those are the types of things that enhance the problem, because they are the people who are going to be believed. Those are the people whose parents are going to trust the children with them. And so that adds an extra element to the danger.
No, I would agree with that. A lot of people would never even question Bill Cosby because he was everybody's father or best friend. So no one would even question, you know, what he did. No one would believe it.
And again, you know, he has not been adjudicated as being guilty of any of these crimes. But there are still people, after the number of victims that have come out and said the same exact thing, some of whom are, you know, fairly well known, and there are still people who don't believe he did it.
Well, there was a woman who actually came forward in Pennsylvania 10 years ago to the prosecutors, and they wouldn't prosecute for just the reason you expressed, that he's a celebrity. However, the statute of limitations for sexual assault in Pennsylvania is 12 years, so Cosby could technically still be prosecuted in Pennsylvania if the prosecutors picked up the case, and now they have all of this other corroborating evidence that he was doing the same thing to all these other women. I'm a little surprised that they haven't picked it up.
Yeah, and we're going to talk a little bit about that, about the statute of limitations and why it protects some of these perpetrators. Let's talk a little bit about the victims, because the victims are the people that you represent as attorneys. Gene, tell us how this case goes. Someone comes to you. How do they generally come to you?
You know, sometimes they come to me from other victims. Sometimes they come to me through the website. And, you know, they come to me. Oftentimes, I'm the very first person that they told. So they've been holding the secret inside sometimes for decades. They haven't even told their parents, a wife, or a friend. And I'm the first person they approach.
I mean, that's got to be really hard to take in, somebody who has that kind of burden on them.
It's you know, really very difficult for the victim. And sometimes, you know, the victim can't even come to the office. There's a lot of trepidation, a lot of fearful. You'd get them on the phone and they still don't want to come in because there's that lack of trust.
And Joe, is it the same?
Yeah, absolutely. Most of these people have really bad post-traumatic stress disorder.
And, you know, and again, not everybody who is sexually abused has like serious problems with conducting their lives. But, you know, Gene, I know that the case that you just settled, the victim had some issues in dealing with life. And we don't want to talk about names or anything like
sure.
that. I just want to talk about the general traits of how this long term affects a person.
You know, it's life lasting. And even with long term therapy, they still have lots of issues. In terms of spirituality, trust, I mean, it's very, very complicated when they have a father figure like a priest who sexually abuses them. So they kind of destroy their trust relationship.
And what do you see? Do you see drug use and alcoholism, you know?
You know, it varies from victim to victim, but I see a lot of drug use. I see a lot of scattered employment history, a lot of difficulty in their marriages, if they can, you know, maintain a marriage. Trust is a big problem.
Yeah, the client I had who was the $28 million verdict, he was a heroin addict by the time he was 15, living in the projects, transferring drugs from one gang to another, and he ended up getting actually very badly beaten, and that's what kind of cleaned him up. He ended up in the hospital with broken legs, and his face was punched in really bad with a bat, and it was the abuse that led him to the heroin addiction.
So when these victims finally come forward after a number of years, which seems like the norm, is it good for them to bring a lawsuit? Put it this way. I think there are some people who say, well, you know, isn't it better just to get your therapy, let it happen? Or is this something good for the victims to come forward in a public setting and bring these lawsuits?
Well, you know, a lot of them don't wind up in a lawsuit, but it's good for them to come forward because they're going to get help. And I have not had a single client come into my door and said, you know, I want millions of dollars. They said, Gene, you know, I need some help. You know, I need some therapy. I just want to deal with this. And that's what I see time and time again.
It also helps them when they come forward that they see that society actually rallies behind them, because they've often felt very guilty about it. And so when society says, no, you're right, we're going after this guy, it gives them positive reinforcement.
And some affirmation that right. what happened to them was not what was supposed to happen to them. And, you know, and I think... How does the church, in your view, I'm going to ask both of you the question, we just have a couple minutes in this segment, how does the church deal with these cases from a litigation standpoint? I mean, obviously, we read about how they've handled the things, and but from a litigation standpoint, are they actively trying to settle cases, or are they fighting them tooth and nail?
Well, in terms of the McCormick cases, it's kind of a mixed bag, because they've taken a very hard line in terms of litigation. I mean, they have tried to resolve it through alternative means, but if you're going to litigate the case, they're definitely not going to make it easy. So it's been, kind of, you know, hand-to-hand combat with them.
It varies diocese by diocese. There's not one church way of dealing with it. It's, you know, if you got the Archdiocese of Chicago, they deal with you one way, Diocese of Joliet another way, because they're all independent organizations, technically.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking some more about these cases with Joe Klest and Eugene Hollander. Give us a call here if you have a question or comment, 312-981-7200, or text us to that number. You're listening to WGN. Karen Conti here. On the other side of the hour, I'm going to be taking your legal calls on any question you might have. I'll give it a shot. 312-981-7200. I'm here with Eugene Hollander and Joe Klest, and we're talking about sex abuse cases. These are lawyers who have tried and settled numerous cases into the millions of dollars for people who are victims of sexual abuse. We got a text from someone who said Denny Hastert has not been officially accused of doing something inappropriate with a minor, but again, I'm going to read that and say that that's what is said, but that's certainly the underlying tone of what was alleged in the extortion complaint that was against him.
That's correct.
Yeah, I don't think there was any question that that was the allegation. Let's talk. Gene, the case you just settled was against the Catholic Church regarding Daniel McCormick, a priest who has been pretty active, according to the allegations and some of the settlements, in being a pedophile. Tell me about the facts of your case.
My clients, the particular interesting fact about this McCormick case is my client was one of the younger victims. He's been linked to many victims. I've personally settled 5 cases involving McCormick, and there's about 17 pending. But in my particular case, my client attended St. Albie's Parish, and McCormick befriended him, and he was sexually abused, you know, at a very early age.
And I'm going to ask this question like everyone asked the question. I know that as a lawyer, and I have, let's just say I have a law firm, and I've got a bad lawyer in my law firm doing dishonest things. Well, you know, I'm going to get rid of that lawyer, and I'm certainly not going to call my friend and get that person hired somewhere else. Nor do I want somebody, even in my profession. I don't like people who are doing the wrong thing. It gives us all a bad name. Tell me, Joe, why is it that the Catholic Church pushed these guys around and moved them all over the place and never got rid of them or did something about them?
Well, again, it depends on the diocese because they were, I hate to defend them much, but they were relying on the best psychologists and psychiatrists that they could get advice from. So I read all of the LA documents, and in most cases they would, you know, send them to a psychologist. The psychologist would say, no, you can't put this guy back. And mostly they wouldn't. But
that's
also
not the ones we hear about. I mean,
no, we don't.
The ones that I hear about are the ones that get moved all over the country.
And that has happened as well. But again, it varies diocese by diocese. One of the reasons that they move them around is because the structure of the Catholic Church is that once you're a priest, you're always a priest until the Pope kicks you out.
Okay.
So they have to do something with them. And again, a lot of dioceses got bad advice from the best psychologists in the world. Some of them were a little bit more cavalier about it. I want to say the Diocese of Joliet was one of the worst because the bishop at the time didn't really understand this, nor maybe he didn't care. Bishop Imish was a terrible guy. He just moved them because he didn't think it was a big deal.
And have things changed? I mean, you know, I'm going to ask you this question because I'm going to play devil's advocate. A lot of people, I hear them say, well, you know, okay, this is what happened, but is it really going to help them to get millions of dollars? I mean, is this how we compensate someone? Is this going to really make them feel better about what happened, get rid of the problem, or is this just something that lawyers make money on? I'd like you to address that, Eugene.
Sure. Well, you know, this is the system we have, and these people, you know, we deal with all sorts of personal injury cases where people, you know, have broken limbs or lose body parts, but with this particular kind of case, they're irreparably damaged, and even with lifelong therapy, you can't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. So this is the system we have, and we do our best to make them whole again.
Well, and it also helps the victims feel good because they're forcing the organization to address the problem. I mean, if somebody's paying millions of dollars because of what happened to you, they're going to be pretty careful about the next time they do something like that.
And I think that's a fair statement of any kind of case. You know, as a litigator, and I'm a litigator, when I win something for my client or settle something for my client, which is usually how things get resolved ultimately, there is a good feeling when a person has a settlement of X amount of dollars, whether it's $10,000 or whether it's $100,000 or $1 million. It's the label that they can give to the resolution of their problem. And whether that's they're going to put it into a bank account or they're going to buy grand piano or they're going to put their kids through college, it has now a label that they did something that was positive out of a negative situation.
I'd agree with that.
Sure.
Let's talk about the statutes of limitations, because we have the people that I mentioned, Dennis Tastert, Bill Cosby, and some of these people, Josh Duggar, who I don't even know. I don't watch that television show. But all these names are being battered about, and it seems like there's no way to have them criminally prosecuted and very few ways to have them civilly sued. And now, Joe, you told me that there might be a way to have Bill Cosby prosecuted in Pennsylvania. But other than that, like, let's just say Illinois. What's the statute of limitations for...
You mean criminal?
Let's talk about criminal.
Well, for example, in Illinois, I think it's 20 years, actually. But back then, when Hastert was doing whatever he was doing, it was 2 years. However, the statute of limitations in Illinois and Wisconsin and some other states is such that it only runs while you're standing on that state's soil. For example, I had a client who came to me when he was 35. He went up to Wisconsin, tried to prosecute there. They didn't want to do it. We showed him the statute, and the priest ended up in 8 years in jail. So it's possible. Hastert was taking the wrestling team on tournaments, A reporter told me that he went to Virginia and went to Colorado. So if he molested somebody there, it's possible he could still be criminally prosecuted.
Okay. And what about civil lawsuits, Gene?
Yeah, well, in civil lawsuits, for instance, in the Hastert case, if it's in Illinois, it's going to be a very, very difficult, if not insurmountable problem for a number of reasons, at least with respect to the school district. They're going to have to show willful conduct on behalf of the school district. And it's going to be very, very difficult in terms of statute of limitations.
Do you feel that you're bringing these lawsuits against the Catholic Church and some of the priests, has it changed their mentality? Do you think that they now are doing things a little bit differently?
Yeah, I think they're trying. I think they're trying to do the right thing. But there's still evidence, for instance, in the Archdiocese of Minneapolis, one of my experts in my case that I just resolved, she was essentially the chief canon lawyer for the Archdiocese of Minneapolis and resigned because of alleged current practices of covering up current sexual abuse crimes.
So it's still going on.
It's apparently still going on.
And there's still cover-up going on. What do you think, Joe? Do you think things have changed for the better? Because actually, you know, sometimes money is what motivates people to change, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, I think a lot of dioceses have changed their practices. The Diocese of Joliet has improved significantly. I think the Archdiocese of Chicago is trying in some cases to do the right thing. So I think the loss of money has brought them to the table to say, hey, we got to deal with this issue because we just can't keep
shelling out the
money. Right?
Yeah. And, you know, and even just not to, that's a perfect analogy, but John Burge, the former commander in the Chicago police force, who was, you know, beating up defendants for years, and there was a cover up of that. And, you know, I mean, all of the money that got spent on him, the payouts, defending the police, defending him, prosecute, you know, all of these things, the wrongful convictions. I mean, it's into the tens of millions of dollars. You know, and if nothing else, you know, if nothing else, that money is going to maybe change things for the better, I would hope.
Well, that's the purpose of tort law, to compensate the victim and keep the bad guy from doing the bad stuff.
Right, because money is sometimes the only motivation. You know, I'm going to talk a little bit about the Jerry Sandusky case. And what we saw there was we saw some people who were around Jerry Sandusky. This was the Penn State coach who was abusing some of the young boys that he was in an organization that he was helping young boys. And they didn't report, or they didn't clearly report what was going on. And as you both know, as lawyers, we have certain mandatory reporters. For instance, in Illinois, nurses and doctors, health care workers, I think even funeral directors might be on the list. But these are people that have to report a suspicion of sex abuse or physical abuse. Do you think that people take those duties seriously under the law?
I think they do now, Karen. I mean, it may not have been as serious, you know, 15, 20 years ago, but I think today they take them very seriously. And very interestingly, you bring up Sandusky. That's the prime reason my client came forward in the case they just settled, because you heard the Sandusky case broke, and that brought him something in his mind that said,
okay,
hey, I got to tell my story.
Right.
It depends on the situation. I mean, individual therapists and counselors, they're all reporting because they're not tied to the perpetrator. Sandusky was a little different because he was famous and powerful, and these people who knew, their careers were tied to his. So if his career blew up, their career was going to blow up. So I think individuals, like, you know, somebody goes to a psychologist and says, I was molested by my grandfather or something, they're going to report it for sure because they're not connected to that individual.
Yeah, and I think the training is so much better today than it was 10, 15 years ago. And now there's a lot more training and obligations and instruction on that.
Do you see that Bill Cosby is ever going to be prosecuted? I mean, you talked a little bit about the Pennsylvania statute of limitations might be open. And, you know, and is it something that should happen?
Oh, I think so. I mean, with all the great numbers of women who have come forward with the exact same story, I'm frankly surprised that the Pennsylvania prosecutors haven't picked up the case again.
I can't tell you over the years how many women have come to my office, say they're at a bar with a friend, and all of a sudden they wake up 2 days later and they're somewhere else and they don't know where they were and they weren't drunk because they only had one drink. And, you know, there's a date rape situation, and it happens all the time. And they say that, you know, these are the kind of people that don't report because they feel embarrassed. They feel like,
sure,
they did something wrong, or they shouldn't have had that one drink, or they should have been more careful, or they shouldn't have been out at a bar. But these are things that are going to continue.
I think they are. And, you know, if Cosby can be prosecuted, I agree with Joe, he should be. But as a practical matter, I think, unfortunately, it's unlikely.
Yeah. I'd like you to both give out your names and your numbers. Eugene Hollander, please give everybody your phone number and your contact information.
Sure. 312-425-9100. EKHlaw.com is my website.
And Joe Klest?
847-969-9510. And my website or my email is chicagotriallaw.com.
And you can always reach me at kconti@kcontilaw, and I can certainly give you their contact information. You're listening to Karen Conti on WGN. On the other side of the hour, I'm going to be taking your legal calls, 312-981-7200.